The reading is on page 744, and it's taken from Isaiah chapter 55. So that's 744. Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And he who has no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money and without price. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? Listen diligently to me, and eat what is good, and delight yourselves in rich food. Incline your ear and come to me. Hear, that your soul may live. And I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. Behold, I made him a witness to the peoples, a leader and commander for the peoples. Behold, you shall call a nation that you do not know, and a nation that did not know you shall run to you, because of the Lord your God, and of the Holy One of Israel, for he has glorified you. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord, that he may have compassion on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there, but water the earth, making it bring forth and sprout, giving seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes out from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, but it shall accomplish that which I purpose and shall succeed in the thing for which I sent it. For you shall go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall break forth into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress. Instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle. And it shall make a name for the Lord, an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off.
Thank you, Charlotte. Thank you very much. And please keep that page open, page 744. When I was eight, the girl that I shared lifts to school with invited me to her birthday party. And looking back at it now, her mum made her, I think. But at the time, it was the most exciting social and romantic development in my life. We went to see Winnie the Pooh at the cinema, and then we went back to her house for the party. And I was not a success. I was probably nervous, I think, and I didn't know her friends very well, so I didn't talk to many people. But worse than anything, my mum had let me choose the birthday present myself. And rather than think carefully about what she might like for her birthday, I'd thought briefly about what I might like for my birthday. And she got a book called How to Write a Computer Game. I still remember her face as she unwrapped it. Now, do you think she invited me again next year? We live in a world, don't we, of very, very few second chances. Wear the wrong thing to an interview. Make a fool of yourself after work. Break a confidence and never be trusted again. It's become a sign of weakness to forgive, hasn't it? I was on jury service when Ashley Cole hit the headlines for sex texting, and it looked at first like Cheryl was going to have him back. And I don't know, maybe it was something about being in the Old Bailey canteen, but no one wanted her to forgive. In fact, most of our jury, they were really angry with her if she did. I wonder, what do you do when you're betrayed? When someone you thought you had a relationship with lets you down? In our chapter tonight, God is offering Israel a second chance. Israel had a relationship with him, like a marriage, and they were unfaithful with other gods and with wrong ways of behaving. So they are in exile in Babylon, which is far more than go and live with your mother, but it's the same kind of idea. And no one is blaming Cheryl, are they, for divorcing Ashley? And just like that, no one would blame God for never wanting to see them again. But last week we heard about Jesus. We heard in chapter 53 that Jesus has transferred all their guilt onto his own head. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. So this week, they get invited back. Given the second chance. Come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. Which, just flick ahead to the very last page of the Bible. Last page of the Bible of all. There's a kind of index, and there are some bits of information no one really wants to know about weights and measures, and then there it is. And if you turn there, it turns out that this offer in our chapter is the ultimate and essential offer that God makes to all human beings. So Revelation 22, verse 17, the Spirit and the Bride say, come. And let the one who hears say, come. And let the one who is thirsty come. Let the one who desires take the water of life without price. And then back a page again in 21, verse 6. It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. Isaiah 55 is God's offer for the end of the world. Life after death, heaven, his new creation, is the place, 22 verse 1, where the water of life flows like a river from his throne. And anyone who is thirsty and wants life needs to come. And they'll have it without payment. So turn back to Isaiah 55. And we will look at what God said to Israel about a second chance after their exile. But as we look at it, you need to realize God is speaking today too. That a voice of power and of love is offering you a second chance. And asking you where you will be in eternity. Now, in our verses, we have the same pattern twice. There's an invitation, come, then the sales pitch, why you should, and then the explanation, why God would do this. So the invitation, the sales pitch, then the explanation. So point one, come and be satisfied. And three times in verse one, God says, come. There are four in our English translation. And there is the invitation. And each time there's something new to the idea, some development. So come to the waters, everyone who thirsts. And I guess we're not really used to how bad it feels to be thirsty, are we? On Friday, my medium Coke at McDonald's had two words on the side. It said thirst and it said fun. And that is not the idea here. Between exile and home for the Israelites is a huge desert. They understood thirst, and God offers water. Come. And second time, he who has no money, come buy and eat. From chronic thirst to starvation, come and eat. And third time, buy wine and milk without money and without price. The person with no money goes home with food and milk and wine. But please don't imagine a soup kitchen. Here, God's invitation isn't for Israel to sort of gather her rags about her and come and queue for a cup of slops. This is far, far better. This is God giving back the credit cards. that the food comes from Harrods or Borough Market. Verse 2 ends, eat what is good, delight yourselves in rich food. You go in with dignity and you have whatever you want. Costly, expensive food. It just isn't you that's paying. Chapter 54 and 55, they are the conclusion to chapters 40 to 55. And we want Israel in restored relationship with God, and we want them back in the promised land, but her sin and unfaithfulness mean that can't happen. All the way until chapter 53, where we meet the servant, who we saw last week is Jesus himself. There's no way back until Jesus dies. And then there is the water of life and the food that delights. And it costs a great deal, but you don't need to pay. Jesus has done that for you. Your account at Harrods has been credited with unlimited funds. So come. And verse 2, just think a little bit about how little you would be leaving behind if you did. Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which does not satisfy? That's a sad image, isn't it? It's Israel, she's poor, she's in exile, she's working on servant wages, and she is hungry. But she's spending all she has on not bread, which does not satisfy. And in context, I think Isaiah means the other gods that Israel has been worshipping. They've worshipped lies, so they feed on ashes, a verse in chapter 44 says. See, to come to God, you would need to leave behind what you worship now. But how bad would that really be? How satisfying is life without God, really? I don't know, does worshipping the exam results make you feel full now that the final paper has been sat? Or stuffing the bank balance, that's a useful thing to do. But do any of the things you spend it on, do they taste like the waters of life? Do they go on feeling and tasting like real life? In John chapter 6 and John chapter 7, Jesus makes the same offer. He says, I'll give you the end of spiritual thirst and hunger, which nothing else in life can do. He says, I will put my spirit in you to well up continually inside you with streams of living water. Why do you spend your labor for that which does not satisfy? Instead, verse 3, incline your ear and come to me. Come to me. Water and milk and food, they're illustrations, aren't they, obviously, for what God is really offering, which is a relationship with him. Come to me. Come back to me. Come and be friends with God the Creator. And the way to respond is to incline your ear and to hear. Both halves of the chapter focus in on God's words. To come is to listen to God, to listen to those words and trust them, respond to them. Come to me, hear, that your soul may live. And that is the full scope of the offer. In Revelation, at the end of the Bible, the answer to death is to come to God without payment and to say, I am thirsty. Life without you does not satisfy, and he will make your soul live for eternity. I don't know, what would you give a friend who'd let you down? How many second chances would you give an unfaithful betrayer? Jesus has given me himself, his life, his death, and relationship with him, and life itself forever. That satisfies. And he's given me second chances and third chances and thousandth chances, and I paid nothing. It's quite an invitation, isn't it? So verses 1 to halfway through verse 3, they're the invitation. Verse 3 to verse 5 is the sales pitch, the reasons why you should take up this offer. And in the first bit, it's all about David. I will make with you an everlasting covenant, my steadfast, sure love for David. That says the second chance God is offering is not a final trial period. I'll have you back for a couple of weeks, but the moment you step out of line, it is over forever. This is come back and we will make the eternal covenant of David. God's promises to the greatest king of Israel ever, that his successors would rule the nation forever. It's a promise of stability. Your king will never die, and his rule will never end, and you will be secure forever. And verse 4 tells us about that real historical David. And then verse 5 could describe Israel. You know, you will call a nation once that happens. But you in verse 3 was plural, and in verse 5 it is singular. So I'd say God is addressing a new David. It's hard, isn't it, to have the everlasting rule of David without somebody to play David. Which means this verse, verse 5, brings together everything the first half of the book said about a new Messiah, a new David, and everything the second half of the book has been saying about a servant who will suffer and will die. How can those two people be the same person? Well, in Acts 13, the reference is on your sheet, Paul makes the same point, does the same work. Because Jesus rose from the dead, he can be the servant who dies and also the king who lives forever, which means the blessings of David are coming to you and nothing can shake them. So Jesus, behold, you shall call a nation that you do not know, and a nation that did not know you shall run to you. That is my license and my prayer tonight, isn't it? My license to offer this second chance to everybody here, even if you're not Jewish, not part of the nation of Israel. And my prayer then is that people here who've never done so would run to Jesus when they hear his call. Then the end of verse 5 is the explanation. Why would God do this? It's all about Jesus and it's all about God. It's because he has glorified you, Jesus, and because of himself, because of the Lord your God and the Holy One of Israel. He does it because he's great and because doing this most glorifies his son Jesus. So that's the first half now. Let's do it all again. Point 2, seek and be pardoned. Verses 6 to 13. The invitation is there in the beginning. The command is to seek the Lord and call upon him. And there is urgency to it. Did you hear that this time? This is different. Call on him, seek him while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. How many people in my generation believe in God, but think that they have all of the time that they need? Yeah, when I'm married, then I won't have to choose between sex and believing in God. I'll do it then. When I've had my fun, God will still be there waiting. That's his job. When I'm old, on my deathbed, that is the time for God. If Cheryl offered Ashley a way back, and you were his friend, would you advise that? Would you advise leave it for a year or two? If you were given a second chance, let's wait. Just wait till you've had your fun and then see if she'll have you back. It misses completely, doesn't it, what it's like to be the wronged party. It misses completely. There's nothing in us to mean that God sort of owes us this generosity. It also doesn't understand what our hearts are like with spiritual things. You know, it's just not possible to be really interested in God and keen to take up his offer and then just put that on pause indefinitely. If you feel tonight that God is calling you, then you cannot put that on ice and expect it still to be there when you're 70. It just doesn't work like that. I've known lots of people who get to the very, very edge of trusting in Jesus, and then something holds them back. I don't know, a fear of what their parents will say or a moral choice they just can't face. And they pause and they say, maybe later. I know it's true, but maybe later. And even, to be honest, even a few months later, they've changed. The heart has hardened over and they're used to the food that doesn't satisfy again. And they persuaded themselves that maybe they never really believed it anyway. I'm thinking especially maybe of students here who've been investigating Jesus this year. What will you do with what you found out about him before this term ends, before you go away for 3 months from all your friends who are Christians? And ultimately, when we get to this verse in Revelation, there is a day when Jesus will return. And it will be too late to make that decision anymore. And Revelation is appealing to us, respond now, come. Take the offer of life before it's too late. Seek him while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. And what does it mean to seek? That's in verse 7. It is to forsake your own way and return to the Lord. Forsake and return. Those are the two ideas bound up in the Bible, idea of repentance. See, verses 1 to 5 told us you don't have to be good to respond to this. You have nothing to buy with. Verses 1 to 5 say, come as you are. But verse 7 says, not to stay as you are. Come as you are, but not to stay as you are. Israel is being asked to leave her idolatry and her wickedness and return to the Lord. And verse 7 is designed to catch the whole scope of human beings, all the ways we turn our back on God, your ways and your thoughts. So maybe it'd be worth thinking through your life while we're speaking. Think through what might need to change if you're to forsake your ways and return to the Lord. Maybe think of your thoughts and your words and your deeds. Or sweep through every arena in which you live your life, your family, your home, your work, your friends. This is not a call to be changed on Sunday only, but a serious call to forsake your ways and return to God's ways. That needs serious thought, doesn't it? But in case listing out all the ways you might have to change terrifies you, well, verse 7 tells you exactly what God will say to the person who forsakes and returns. Let him return to the Lord that he may have compassion on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. God doesn't want you in any doubt about what kind of reception you'll get if you come back. I don't know. I don't really know how blokes ever ask girls out without knowing already what they're going to say. I did that once, and it is a mug's game and needs huge boldness. What blokes need are signs so clear and unsubtle that all there is to worry about is getting her name right when you ask. That is what we need. God does not want Israel to be at all nervous about what kind of answer they're going to get from him. If they seek and forsake and return, he will have compassion and he will pardon. Isn't that different from how saying sorry normally works? Saying sorry is awful, isn't it? Because you completely lose control. The fact you've done something wrong means you go and say sorry and you have no idea what that person will do or say. And your heart is in your mouth as you go to own up. Well, God is a sure thing. He's waiting to have compassion on the wicked and the unrighteous. He's waiting to abundantly pardon, to massively forgive. Jesus has died. Turn back to 53 verse 6. Turn back a page. Chapter 53 verse 6. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. And twice more in the chapter, he bore their guilt. He bore the sin of many. I think I always used to think that forgiveness needed Jesus on a cross and also God in a good mood. And I thought that was the basic job of church and of priests, was to get God in a good mood so that when you showed up with the latest load of sin that you'd done, they would sort of press the Jesus lever and the cross would kick in and you would be okay. And I remember the penny dropping when someone said, do you realize it would be hideously unjust for God not to forgive you, given what Jesus has done on the cross? And no, I did not realize that, because I was so aware of things I did every single day that God should hate. But he was right. If everything of mine is transferred to Jesus, then it is already punished. You know, was there any hate or selfishness or carelessness or pride or showing off, even on my way into church tonight? Well, 2,000 years ago, that was punished fully and entirely. Upon him was the punishment that brought us peace. God can't punish me now. if he's already punished him then? So seek, call on him, forsake and return, and get ready for the compassion and the pardon of your God. Have you ever been made an offer like this? Come and be satisfied. Seek and be pardoned. And again, Isaiah gives us reasons. There's a heap of reasons here to take seriously the best offer you have ever been made. Verse 8, verse 10, and verse 12 all start with 4. Three reasons why you should in this sales pitch. Because, verse 8 and 9, because his thoughts are different to yours. They're higher than yours. I think lots of people struggle to believe that God would forgive them simply because if you were God, there would be no chance. My thoughts are not your thoughts. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than yours. I wouldn't forgive Ashley if I was Cheryl. I wouldn't forgive Charlie if I was God. But I am not. I'm not God. And he is different. And also because, verse 10 and verse 11, because the word you're hearing now is uniquely powerful and successful. It says that rain and snow, they plummet down from heaven. That's what's great about them. They plummet down, they make everything green and alive, and they only go back to the clouds once they've done that. So that's the illustration, verse 10. Now let me tell you about God's word, verse 11. It goes out the same way, from heaven, from God's mouth, and it never returns to him empty. And if rain can find its way to the roots of trees, is the point, then God's words can find their way into your heart. Not empty, but it shall accomplish that which I purpose, and it shall succeed in the thing for which I sent it. Which is meant to unsettle Isaiah's audience, I think, and I hope it unsettles you here tonight. You know, what word are we talking about? What message is it that the prophet is talking about? What is God intending for you to incline your ear to and hear right now? It is his offer of a second chance. Come to me. Seek, call, forsake, and return. I don't know, if you imagine God leaving you the book of Isaiah like an email that you could kind of open whenever you feel like and pretend you never received and delete if you think it's spam, then think again if you imagine that. His words are not so cold and dead as that. He sends them, and they seek out the place he wants them to go, and they accomplish his purpose. They're active. Then third reason, verse 12 and verse 13, is what he is offering you. He's offering you joy and peace. And peace there is so much more than the sort of absence of stress. Peace there is the end of the war. Chapter 48 gave us the great stumbling block between human beings and God. There is no peace for the wicked. That isn't just a phrase the way your colleague might say it when they're asked to organize the Christmas party. That is what has been wrong between human beings and God ever since the beginning of the Bible, ever since human beings first rebelled against God. There's been no peace. There's been war between God and human beings until Jesus. Until upon him was the punishment that brought us peace. And in particular here, God means an entirely new world, an entirely new relationship between human beings and him, and an entirely new world to live in, a reordered new creation. There are hills doing all sorts of crazy things, and mountains and trees are clapping, and God and human beings are at peace again, and they're so pleased, the trees are clapping, and all the plants of the curse, verse 13, are replaced. It's not literal, I don't think, but it's a picture of how amazing a new world would be when the war is over because of Jesus' death. So three reasons in the sales pitch, and then the explanation, which are the last words in verse 13. God, this just seems all too good to be true. Why would you do this? Why would God do this? Because the restoration of people who need a second chance, and a third, and a thousandth, that, verse 13, shall make a name for the Lord, an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off. Isn't that mind-blowing and reassuring? See, God does this for me in his compassion and his love for me, but he also does it to make a name for himself, to make a sign to the universe that he is the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, a sign to say, look, he must be, to have taken that proud scumbag Charlie back 20 years ago and to have pardoned him everything since then. And look, he must be, because his son's kingdom includes thieves and cheats and betrayers. That's just the 12 apostles. And sexual failures and God murderers and Satan's own possessions. That's other people we meet in the Gospels, and Nazis and terrorist bombers and sneering secularists and everybody who thirsts but has nothing to give him. He must be very great if he does that. On Thursday, President Obama pointed out it's hard to entirely trust BP in the Gulf of Mexico because, he said, BP's interests may not be aligned with the public interest. If you're relying on BP to tell you if there's any oil still coming out, there may be a problem with that. Well, isn't this mind-blowing and reassuring? God's interests, when it comes to pardoning me, are entirely aligned with mine. The thing that brings him the greatest name is the thing I most want and I most need. Isn't this an amazing chapter? When you look back on it as a whole, isn't it all upside down? Isn't it amazing that he should be asking me back? He's not begging, but amazing. He's spending so many words to reassure and to promise and invite and call back the unfaithful one. It's almost as if God was the one who'd done something wrong, isn't it? The way the language goes, the way he's pushing us to respond. So much does he love you that he sent his only son to die for you and pay the price. And he has spent the last half hour calling on you to take that second chance. I'm going now to pray verse 6 and verse 7. And anybody who wants to obey that call tonight, I suggest you make that your prayer to God and pray along with it as I pray. Let's pray. Father God, we are amazed by you and we want to seek you while you may be found. We want to say that we have been wicked, but that we forsake our own way and want to return to you, Lord, that you would have compassion on us and abundantly pardon us and give us life to satisfy and end the thirst. We thank you for Jesus, for his death, that you make this amazing offer and invitation to us. Amen.